This is sort of, I'm actually kind of shocked at how kind of, it's like synchronicity. Like, I feel like this is the kind of, the last few years especially, I've been really losing faith in people and humanity, and just not, it's something that I'm personally struggling with. So to kind of read this, that I'm not the only one kind of thing, I don't know, I just feel sort of a bit more, validated in it's okay to kind of have those to be confused.
Disenchantments with the world. Okay, confused is a bloody good word. And did you get sort of bogged down in it and just found it too difficult to keep going?
No, I definitely, I wanted to keep going and see these different kind of, mirroring and philosophers and artists through history have, this has obviously been a human question that people ask, but sort of within themselves, like not really public sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, good description.
I don't know if I'm making
people ask
sense.
within themselves. People ask within themselves.
Those doubts that people have, but aren't sort of comfortable in sharing them. We sort of feel like we have to feel like we know everything, and
Good comment. We have to feel. I'm just slow, right? We have
That's sorry.
So you found it reasonably accessible reading it.
And just there hasn't been books sort of like that in a very long time. Even the ones similar that make thought-provoking, and it's been a long time since, like maybe 15 years since I really read something that inspired it, just in this kind of vein of really wanting to get to the bottom of and questioning human beings and their actions.
What's going on?
And I think it's kind of it's a good time with the world the way it is. It's I think more and more people need to reflect and not just go through life blindly, kind of.
Oh, you're doing well.
I'm sorry, it's
You might come up here,
a bit
actually.
deep.
No, you're doing wonderfully well. The world the way it is, more people need to reflect. No.
But that's a pressure in itself as well. So, people sort of steer, even people that want to kind of avoid it because it's facing things that the unknown, it's the scary, it's all those kind of.
Good on you, Tabitha. Well done. Did you find the subject interesting or?
Yeah, definitely. Especially when he was talking about your when you were an adolescent. I experienced it myself when I was 16, 17 years old. And it's pretty interesting to read from someone who is definitely an expert in it.
Coming back and
Always.
so
My
what,
pleasure.
What's your feedback? What's your thoughts?
I think when you're going to sell the book, make sure that you put a little DVD of this recording from last Tuesday in it. That helps. It helped me. It definitely helped me. My English is not my native language, so some parts I was struggling with it, but with your
You're Dutch, aren't you?
I'm Dutch.
Yes.
So with your lecture, I thought it was a not really good lecture of Tuesday. It helped me. I start reading it again, and it was, oh yeah, okay. You're in denial, and makes more sense. Especially when I read chapter two after that with the bird. It's good. I want to read more. I want to read more.
But whereas my first reading was quite, in many respects, repelled by it because not only was it confronting, but I didn't understand how the material put together. I didn't really understand whether all the references were necessarily relevant. And I think I used the language before that they appeared selective. On a second reading, it became much clearer. I could see the coordination, I could see the logic between them, and I felt perhaps much more comfortable with the context, even though the concept itself was still very challenging. It's certainly confrontational, it's material and ideas that I've not come across before, I'll be honest, and it is leading one to take a view of the world quite contrary to the one that I spent 50-odd years growing up with. So I'm not embarrassed that I'm saying that I don't fully understand it still, and I'm not fully comfortable with it. But I am very comfortable with the idea that it's a very interesting read, and one which is prompting me to explore some dark corners inside myself. And from that point of view, that's what I would call a good book, because it's challenged me in the right places. It's a huge intellectual challenge, and for that point of view, very, very interesting to try to get to grips with.
So what's your background? What are you trained in?
I am a headhunter. I have a law degree, a communications and law degree, but I am not a practicing lawyer at this point.
So why didn't you not practice law?
I did practice for a couple of years, and it just drove me crazy. I was in corporate law, and it wasn't what I wanted to do. To be honest, I really needed chapter two after rereading the first chapter as a bit of a soother because I think I'd obviously absorbed more than I had the first time that I'd read it, and, you know, felt that I was almost descending into that depression, which is disgust. I'm very pleased that I read chapter two, and thank you for providing that. I wondered what I'm supposed to do with this now, and I feel that I need to sit with that question for a period of time before I will know the answer to that. I think that things are happening, you know, and even... You know, I did the second reading yesterday, and today, you know, there was just a situation at work, which I think I did respond to differently to how I may have a week ago. And then I got all confused about my response, basically. So I think I need to sit with it as it is, let things happen subconsciously. And then perhaps read it a third or maybe even a fourth time before I'll be able to comfortably read it. Well, it's partially self-preservation, I think, that I just don't know what to do with it.
Well, you said perhaps I might have been reading it more superficially the first time. Because if you sort of immersed myself in what you said there. You said, look, so I started reading it after our meeting, and I'm reading it more slowly and more deeply, and so much so, in fact, that I start to get depressed, and it's getting too close to the bone sort of thing. And thank goodness I got into chapter two, which has got this redeeming explanation at the end of it, and digs me out of the hole again, you know. So But if you, in terms of what I was hoping for, was that you would be able to go deeper with it, because that's what people do. They read it, and the mind doesn't allow them to go in. They're not aware that that's happening, so they're just skimming it, and they're getting bits out of it. They say, look, it's a very interesting topic, and it's very meaningful, and you should think about that sort of stuff more and more, and all that sort of stuff. But from the experience I've got, I know that they're not really allowing their mind to be immersed in it. So that will happen if what I'm saying is true. That getting familiarised and about this forbidden realm, then when you read it again, you're going to go very deep, because you've suddenly had the depth effect eroded enough. To start hearing what's really being said, and then that will get very scary. So I would argue that it's actually evidence that it did help you penetrate the stuff, so much so that you're seeing too much too quickly.
Possibly,
and you're needing chapter two very to help you bail you out of that death, that nosedive, you know. But
yes.
But and as to what how to cope with it over time, obviously that's a digestion process. So what are you supposed to do with this? If someone can explain something to you, imagine when humans couldn't explain lightning. You know, I mean, how terrified were they? They must have thought they'd done something wrong that day, and that someone's trying to zap them. The gods, you know.
Mm.
I mean, we forget how much knowledge we've got now, and how hard it would have been to be a fully conscious mind living on this planet without any answers. I mean, the sun goes up and comes down. Mm. I mean, you'd be terrified. Is it going to come back tomorrow morning? You know,
yes.
I mean, people were. They went and sacrificed their kids and did terrible things because they're so ignorant, so mysterious. To be awake, thinking, but without any answers, is a terrifying affliction.
Mm.
So we've got a lot of knowledge now. Mm. But what happens with knowledge is it takes time to filter it through and put it into your absorption system.
Mm.
But already you said, you know, I was watching some behaviour. If you listen to the Brian Carlton interview, you'll find that really interesting, I think.
Yeah.
You know, he says, you know, every day when I was listening on the phone to, you know, in the talkback radio, I was understanding things so much better. I had a different take on everything. And there was this filter down. He used the word filter down effect of this information. It was making everything clearer and I could see things. So that's what it's supposed to do for you. It's give you greater understanding and peace of mind and ultimately because you can make sense of experience. So that's what the book is. It transforms humans by bringing them understanding that makes sense of their world at last. So instead of being troubled and bewildered and confused, like Holden Caulfield, he wants to be a catcher in the way. He wants to stop kids having to stop thinking and jump off this cliff. He wants to allow some understanding that will allow them to keep thinking and keep making sense of the world and never have to resort to mysticism or superstition or sacrificing their kids or something terrible, all the horrors that have gone on out of just sheer ignorance.
Mm.
We need brain food, not brain anesthetic. We want answers. But when you get them, and if you get them at this critical work interface of the human condition, these answers are massive in terms of the filter down effect, how much they're going to make sense of everything.
Mm.
It's going to be a huge amount of digestion. So you've got to be patient. At that point, you've got to back off a little bit.
Yeah.
And just put it on the back burners, exactly what you said. Leave it in the back burners and to filter this through, and gradually it should help you and make sense. And that's the benefit of it.
Yes.
That's what all we've always wanted. We wanted something to make sense of all the madness and confusion. But this is based on love and compassion. It's a compassionate understanding, which is what you discovered in chapter two.
Yes.
Gee whiz, Jeremy, you, in chapter one you just buried me deeper into this hole, you know, and I was getting darker and darker. And then, you know, in chapter two you bail me out, you know, I've been thrown around like a rag doll, you know, the good cop, bag cop, you know, he comes in and he gives me a big argument. No, he comes in and belts the living daylights out of me, then, then says I'm a goody-goody, and I don't know whether I'm coming or going at this point.
Mm.
But anyway, so that's just wonderful, Anna, so thank you for that.
We'll get through it together. Thank you, actually.
No.
You know, it's... I'm not saying I agree with absolutely everything, but... Who would say that?
Especially this early stage.
Yes. But, you know, I feel that I've been presented with another perspective. And I am not at a stage yet where I can accept it in its entirety.
You shouldn't.
But it's definitely making me think.
Yeah.
And I will continue to do so, I think. Yeah.
And the next generation coming.
Yes,
very soon. We'll hopefully come into a more tranquil, more self-understood world and peaceful. And it actually should help you. And
parenting,
that's right.
Yeah. Definitely. And I tried to talk to my husband about it, actually. He got very confused, so he'll need to read it himself.
Yeah. So, Craig, thanks for coming back. Obviously, we're interested in your feedback, and you've done your homework, I see, which is wonderful.
I have.
So what are your thoughts?
So it was easier on a second read through, like you said. I don't know if that's just because I've already read the content, or I don't know. It just felt it was easier to read. Maybe I got used to all your style with all your different things in it. Basically, what I still have a problem with is that you say that there are universally accepted ideas of life, and that's being cooperative, loving, and selfless, okay? But I don't know why you say that these are universal. I mean, yeah, they're good attributes, but What makes them universally accepted ideals of life?
Yes. Well, that's what chapter 4 is all about.
Right.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, you guys were only looking at chapters 1 and 2, but there's this thing that's bewildered biologists and troubled biologists. One of the big questions about consciousness, the origins of consciousness, and the human condition is the most important. But the other big mystery has been the origins of our moral nature. So humans do have a moral nature. They've got a propensity for enormous acts of violence and atrocities, but there's also a very sensitive, compassionate, loving side to humans. And it's instinctive, we're born with it kind of thing. It's what we call our conscience.
Yeah.
So in biology, as I said, I don't know what I said to your group, but every second article in the science journals have got a latest theory on the origin of our moral nature.
Right.
So it's an accepted universal thing. And so how could we have acquired that biologically? Since genes are selfish, you know, they'll only foster selfishness. Selfish genes, that's the sort of the biological. So how could a selfish system, namely genetics, which only fosters, because if someone's selfless, presumably they go and give their life for others, unconditionally selfless, give their life for someone else, they're not passing on their genes. So that trait should disappear. How did a selfless, unconditionally selfless, altruistic nature possibly emerge in the human makeup, right? So there's all these theories to try to explain that. And that's what the latter part of chapter 1 talks about, like social Darwinism. No, well, the next one, there was a big flaw with social Darwinism because it talked about humans as being, trying to explain that altruistic nature by saying, well, we're just trying to foster the genes in others to reproduce, trying to indirectly, we're not actually being selfless, we're actually being selfish, because when we act for the others, like an ant in an ant colony, it gives its life to save the little bee. When it stings you, it dies, right? So it's given its life. But evolutionary psychology, truthfully enough, explains that what the ants and the bees are doing in their selfless behaviour, unconditionally self, is actually fostering their own genes by looking after the queen who reproduces them. She's the breeder.
Yeah.
So actually, they're actually still being selfish. They're still meeting the requirements of genes to be selfish, right?
Yeah.
So then but what they did then is they pulled a trick. They said, well, that explains our altruistic nature too, that all we're doing is indirectly being selfish. It's a subtle form of selfishness. When we're kind to somebody, we're just trying to make sure our genes reproduce because they're related to us, like it happens in an ant or a bee colony, which is patently not true.
What about feeling good? What about altruistic behaviour because it feels good?
That's what we would say would be our conscience, that we get... we can all work out rationally that ideally it would be better if everyone was cooperative and loving and selfless, you know. Like that, it's a fairly obvious ideal. And so you could say we've got a conscience, a moral sense, just from being rational, from looking at the ideal would be if everyone was cooperative and loving, like communism, so everyone shares everything. But it's universally accepted that we've got an altruistic moral nature, an instinct which our conscience is the voice of, the expression of within us. And so that we're born with this instinctive propensity to be able to, like this footballer I use in the book, who gave his life trying to save some kids, you know, and he couldn't even swim. But he said, I've got to go and try and help them. And he actually died trying to save these kids in this big pond. And it's universally accepted that we've got this moral nature, but how did we acquire it? That's the great mystery, because all these biological theories that they've used are actually human condition avoiding theories. So that's why the latter part of chapter 1 is so important, because it presents the explanation of how we acquired altruistic moral instincts, but not using a human condition avoiding explanation. See, that's what the whole thing I was trying to explain with the book is. I was trying to explain how once you understand that humans are living in fear of the human condition, so people in the cave are living in fear of the human condition in Plato's cave, they've developed all these theories that want to avoid the human condition, not confront it. So they're dishonest theories, right? And I just gave you the example of evolutionary psychology that says, sure, bees give their life because they're fostering their own reproduction by fostering the queen.
Yeah.
But then to extrapolate that to say that when we behave selflessly towards others, like the guy that footballer that gave his life trying to save those kids, he's actually trying to foster, you know, his genes in the offspring, in those that are related to him, which just doesn't make sense. I mean, those kids obviously, then they'd say, well, that's just an aberration of the basic idea that that's what where people are when they're being selfless. They are trying to. So there's a huge flaw in that argument. So what happened then, you'll see if you read the end of chapter one, is that they switched and tried to come up with another theory, which E.O. Wilson's come up with. They tried to say, okay, that true, we've used that lie long enough, it's not working, let's find another one.
Yeah.
And they've come up with another one. It's even shonkier, it's even more clever, but it's still avoiding the human condition. So if you go to chapter four,
yeah,
supposedly it will explain the real reason how we acquired our moral nature in a human condition confronting truthful manner, right? So that's the thesis of the whole book. Establish that humans are living in denial and can't face the truth in condition. So everything they're saying and all their theories are human condition avoiding, right?
Yeah.
And now we'll go through and look at all these big questions and not avoid the human condition, we'll make sense of them. So what happens when you get to chapter four? So it's this massive question, how did we acquire our unconditionally selfless moral nature, right? This, that our conscience is the voice of within us, that we're all born with kind of thing. We all have this ability. Yeah. And it says that the real reason was through nurturing, which the bonobo is a living example of it occurring.
Right.
Now, the reason that's human condition avoiding had never been admitted, it was actually admitted some 10 years or so, 12 years after Darwin's Origin of Species was published, and it was actually described as a theory far more important than natural selection. You'll see John Fiske admitted it. It's in chapter 5. Look up John Fiske. But that theory was let die, right? Because of the human condition, fear of the human condition. Because if it's true that nurturing made us human, and that nurturing therefore is the most important ingredient in why making us human and our growing up and stuff, it confronts parents with their present inability to nurture their children as much as they were before the human condition. So, as I say in the book, you know, parents would rather admit to being an axe murderer than a bad parent. So it's an unbearable truth. First, explain the human condition, the good reason for our upset, corrupted, angry, egocentric, and then we can safely admit all these other truths. So chapter two admits all these, says explanation of the human condition. Now we're defended. I can go and talk about nurturing being the prime mover in human development and in our own lives, and because we're now defended, we can explain why all mothers and fathers are variously alienated, and certainly when children come into the world, they're hurt by that falseness. Their parents do their best, but they can't hide it. They can't be not alienated, so that children can see it and die a lot, you know, and so they're very hurt by that.
What about morals as a invention of the rational mind?
Well, as
opposed to as something intrinsic.
Yeah. I said, and I think if you read in there, I did say that a little while ago, that we can work out that for a group of people if they cooperate, they can do a lot better. If everyone's loving and selfless and cooperative and considerate of others, it'll be a much more efficient system. So you can work it out just rationally, as you just said, you know, that there's this moral ideal and that's apparent without a conscience. I mean, it's just from logic, from just observation, that things work better if everyone is selfless and cooperative. But that's the human condition. Why aren't we like that, you know? So, we can work out... talk about in my book three ways we can work out that the ideals are to be cooperative. One, from our instinctive conscience. Two, from just watching, observing that selflessness is a more efficient system, makes everybody cooperate. And three, because chapter three talks about that we've got this, we recognise that this integrative theme of existence. So we can work it out from, which is really similar to just understanding that things work better if we cooperate. But there is this development of order of matter, it's theme of existence, which is in chapter three. So we can work it out in three ways that selflessness is better than selfishness, if you like.
Yeah, but I'm not trying to say that selflessness isn't better than selfishness.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is don't you think morals might have become existent because that's like because of a societal pressure? Like people want to live, like people want to live with people that they can trust and that they can, you know, get along with.
Yeah.
So that comes from a societal thing rather than as, because I mean, I noticed in the book, you quote Rousseau when he says, you know,
nothing more gentle than man is privileged state.
But what about the other philosophers like Hobbes who said that, you know, man was just a primitive savage who just followed his own, followed his own, like basically utility maximizing. I do what I want because it feels good. Yeah. What about
and,
that?
And because I'm trying to reproduce the genes and I've got to defend my territory, my family, you know, that's what the latter part of chapter one deals with. All these reasons that we have used to deny this condemning truth that Brousseau, because at the end of evolutionary psychology in chapter, if you look up evolutionary, you'll see that he actually, E.O. Wilson, who was the advocate of evolutionary psychology, said, you know, and Rousseau was horribly wrong when he said that nothing is more gentle than man is primitive state.
Yeah, I saw that quite right.
So, we're talking about the human condition here because humans don't want to admit that truth because it's so condemning. So they're trying to find all these ways of escaping the condemning truth. So if a society is too idealistic and says everyone should share and cooperate, and we are sufferers of the human condition, we're aggressive and angry and competitive, the opposite.
Yeah.
And someone gets too idealistic, like socialism, it falls apart because there's too much social expectation of everyone being loving and cooperative, and it's unrealistic. It's not recognising the human condition. That's why chapter two is so good, supposedly, because it explains why we had to become selfish and aggressive. Do you know what I mean? But in the course of searching for knowledge. So chapter two is a defence of our corrupted state. So that explains that why socialism and all these idealistic movements were false starts to any utopian world, because they hadn't solved the human condition yet. You know, you can't, everyone fly back on course and be ideal until we're understood, anyway.
So, and so you also say, like, with regards to the human condition, you say that it comes about because our instincts go against what our rational mind wants us to. So our instincts want us to do is against what our rational mind wants us to do.
Yes, yes.
Why do you think that is?
Okay. Yeah, we're looking for the explanation for the human condition, right?
Yeah.
And the thesis is in the latter part of chapter one, and I talk about all the biological theories that have been put forward, and I've just been talking about some of them.
Yeah.
And I'm saying they don't cut it. They really don't genuinely explain us. They're actually trying to avoid the human condition, not confront it. And what I also say, after the end of chapter one, so now let's try to think about everything assuming the human condition and I suggest that all these questions will be very simple to answer. And let's look at the first problem, where the biggest of all, the human condition itself. How do we explain that? And then I say, to answer your question, is, well, just let's think about it. And I begin with a quote from Huxley or somebody saying, look, what would happen when an animal that was being controlled by its instincts became fully conscious?
Yeah.
Inevitably, there'd be a clash. So that's a sort of an obvious...
But I'm saying why? Why do you think that there's a clash between what we're genetically, like what our instincts are and what our mind is
well,
thinking?
Well, we're trying to explain the human condition. That's the destiny of the exercise, right?
Yeah.
So we're trying to find some explanation that would make sense of that, right?
Yeah.
That there would be this clash. So all I'm saying that anybody thinking truthfully about it would recognise in the first step of the argument that when we became conscious, that being an insightful learning system, there had to be a clash with the already established, the already established orientating learning system, which is genetics. So therein is the roots of the explanation, because if we think enough about that, it would produce the human condition. It would explain why we behave the way we are, and therefore it would make sense of. And if you look at chapter 7, it goes through if we interpret the whole of human development from the time we were apes. Using that explanation, everything starts to fall out. It makes sense of, like I was, in our talk we were talking about children, you know,
like they starting to encounter the human condition and get more frustrated and so on, and then they start thinking about it and so on. So that's all based on some awareness that there is this problem, this something's gone off the rails, right? And so if you interpret human behavior using that explanation, it will make sense. And the fact that it makes sense is the evidence that that explanation works, that it's truthful. Like the one, I don't know whether I mentioned it in our talk, but if you go and look at Brian Carlton's interview, you know, he said, look, when you get it, when it, you can actually remember the day, the moment, the page number, when you finally realise that that really does explain the human condition, that little Adam Stork story or whatever, because you can experience the truth of it, that it really does make sense. And the more you look down into it, so if you were really stridently cynical, which everyone should be ideally, right?
Yeah.
And you're good on that. You're really good on that.
Right.
No, you are.
Yeah.
And you should be. And you're not going to be bulldozed. You're rational, right? Very rational bloke. So you want to know just exactly how do you know that's true? That is the explanation, right? So, but the more you study that, look at that, the more true it would be that there were a clash had to occur, right? And the nature of that. I mean, even you go right back into the mythologies, like in Genesis and in the Christian mythology, which is, well, it's in Genesis, is in basis of Judaism and in Islam, you know, Moses, and Christianity. And Genesis says, we took the fruit from the tree, we're living in this Garden of Eden, presumably innocent state, free human condition, innocent state. Then we took the fruit from the tree of knowledge, became conscious, and then the shit hit the fan. So it's got the elements there. Sort of now that we can explain the pre-conscious state, which is the gene-based orientating system, and then we can explain that we became conscious. See, already there's a recognition there, and that's when Moses wrote that 2000 BC or whatever, a long time ago. You know, it's an obvious truth that these two factions exist in us.
So are you saying, for example, as a practical example to that our genes would tell us? So if we were hungry and someone else had food, our genes would tell us to steal and our rational mind would feel bad about it? Is that what you...
No, it's the opposite. What happens is, I'm saying, the Adam Stork story just says birds are instinctively orientated where they fly and not, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously we're not birds, and our orientation wasn't to a flight path. Our orientation, I'm saying, was in chapter 4, says that we were once nurtured to acquire this unconditionally selfless, loving soul, instinctive self. So I'm saying our instinctive self was to be cooperative, loving, and selfless, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but it wouldn't matter what sort of instinct you had. If you then become conscious, there's going to be a clash between that and that, right? Between the instinctive way that just wants you to behave obediently to these orientations, they're not understandings. And then you need to experiment and understanding and do things differently. A chook wants to sit on her eggs for 28 days, you know. They're instinctively selected to do that or whatever it is. Well, if the chook starts to think for itself and get off the eggs, you know, and carry out all these, all mayhem breaks out. So it. But in our case, it was so much worse. It's called the double and triple whammy. The double whammy is just that. In our case, when we got angry, egocentric and alienated for being criticised, for experimenting and understanding, now those behaviours themselves are also going to get condemned by our particular instincts because we're now offending our conscience. So it got really bad for us. And there's a third whammy is there as well because we're defying integrative meaning.
How is our conscience separate from our rational mind, though? How can our conscience not like what our rational mind is? Like, how did they develop as separate things?
Okay, well, if you want, you have instincts that make you go to the toilet or want to have food or whatever, and you can consciously override that. You can say, I'm not going to go into the toilet now, or I'm not going to go and get a feed now. You can override your instincts. And so we've got instincts that want us to behave cooperatively and lovingly and selflessly, but we can defy those. Our conscious mind can fight. We do it all the time. So, that instincts, in effect, I always use the word, in effect, criticise us. They just want us to do, in effect, want us to behave in a certain way. But when we're conscious and now self-adjusting, we tend to do it, might often end up doing it in a different way. And at that point, the instincts are distressed, if you like, or in effect, criticise, They don't want that to happen. They try to pull... When storks are perfectly orientated to fly around Africa and they get around the hook in Africa, and any that have got that instinct start trying to fly across the Sahara, their instinct is going to pull them back on course. Do you know what I mean? They're very powerful. Instincts are very powerful. They let us know when we want to have a feed, when our body needs food or whatever it is. So instincts can influence us and make us want to do things. And if we then become conscious, sufficiently conscious to wrest management control from the instincts, take over.
Yeah.
Right? For a long time, the instincts are still going to be in control. They're still dominant. They're going to be so powerful, so well entrenched. But eventually, if we become sufficiently conscious, able to understand cause and effect sufficiently, we're going to challenge that, and then we're going to get ourselves into trouble. Because the instincts are going to, we're going to be at odds with our instincts. And our instincts were to be cooperative and loving. And now we're getting aggressive and competitive. We're really in big, big trouble. And that's why I say, if you really immerse yourself in that, where are these volcanic forces within us? Sure, we've civilized and tried to restrain them, but there's huge volcanic forces in humans. Real deep anger that's coming from somewhere, violence and brutality and torture and capacities that are real. There's some real bad psychosis coming from somewhere. But if you immerse yourself in that little struggle between those two factions, and we're unfairly condemned and can't explain why, we're going to get really upset, really. And it's a double and triple whammy because we're getting doubly condemned. So now old Adam Stork is absolutely furious because we're not Adam Stork. We're cooperative and loving, instinctively orientated. And then suddenly we've become monsters. I mean, you know, we're going to feel the burden of guilt is just going to become astronomical. No wonder we're furious inside. And it comes out in war and so on, and people torture each other, and there is something really horrific volcanic anger within us. And so that's, we can now, the more you immerse yourself in that theory and walk around with it, the experience is that what happens is it gets more and more accountable. And that's what Brian Carlton says, gee, when it clicks that this actually starts to make sense of what you're looking at everywhere, it's really powerful. So it is a fair bit to sort of get your head around. It takes a bit of reading and you need to, you know, remain objective and keep questioning.
Yeah.
And you can send me an email anytime and I'll try and help you. But just read it and keep reading it and just keep your judgment in reservation, as you should. And you'll definitely do that because you're very rigorous, which is wonderful. Until it does supposedly make sense of things. Either it'll grow in its accountability or it won't. So you're on safe grounds. Especially if you're a very rational person like you are. So, you know, that's the best I can sort of explain it.
Okay, so let's just say I finish the book, yes. Which I plan to finish it, yes. Because it seems unfair to make a judgment without reading it in its entirety.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in it.
Yes.
Doesn't that mean I have to admit to myself that I'm a denier? I'm incapable of seeing the truth.
That's what you were raising the other day. That's I remember now. It's called the non-falsifiable principle. Right, and there's certain situations that Freud's penis envy, which where it said, if you say you haven't got it, that's indication that you have.
Yeah.
Right, so now look, I didn't create the dilemma of the human condition, which creates this state of denial and alienation. So it has this aspect, but I didn't create it. It's not a deliberate attempt by me to be devious.
Yeah.
And secondly, very importantly, these theories, these are testable. They're experiment. You can validate them or disprove them. So you're on safe ground. So yeah, superficially, it's a circular argument, and you get condemned as being a classic alien. But you're on safe turf because you can just keep thinking about it and try and find the holes in it.
Yeah.
And then if they serious holes, then you should sweat on them until they either validate themselves or they don't. But you should keep in mind that humans, if the theory is that humans are deeply alienated, that there is this historic fear. So you do have to be very judgmental about this because these are frightful frontiers. You know, this is a professor in Cambridge who loves my stuff, and you know he rang me up. He's actually got a video on the
website.
Yeah,
yeah.
And he's one. He says, Jeremy, I'm running with everything, but one thing I really can't cope with.
Yeah.
I need some help with. not persuaded by, yep, is that, you know, autism is caused by lack of mother's love. And for him, that's, you know, some truth. So I went to great lengths to try to explain that, that look, you've got to expect after 2 million years that we're going to be horrifically upset humans, and no mother's going to be sound and secure enough, and children come in. So it's not mothers going to be loving. Because he said, all mothers are really trying to. I said, I know they are. It's not that. It's that we're 2 million years alienated, and children come in the world still expecting it to be innocent and free of the human condition, and it's not. And so, of course, they die a million deaths. But it's not a lack of love in the sense of intended love. It's just mothers and we're all alienated, and kids can see the difference. Is what happened with resignation. Kids can see through it, and infants can, and so on. And so that's, so, you know, so he's, for him, that's a sticking point.
Yeah.
And he says, well, have a crack at that, Jeremy, see if you can persuade me. And you'll hear at the end, he just says, he smiles and says, I'll take that away on those and give it some thinking, which is good. That's, yeah. I'm cool with that. And he's got to think about that and see if it doesn't gel in his mind after a time that this really does make sense of those things.
Yeah.
So you've got to be, but you have to also consider that humans have got this resistance to not wanting to be honest about this part of themselves. So
yeah,
you've got to have to be fiercely objective, because, you know, it could be because you're trying to block a truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing how powerful this denial is when it gets going, and it can really be determined to not accept a truth.
Yeah.
Because the consequences it's learned are terrible, a fearful depression. So, you know, that you, and that's the hard thing to differentiate about.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got that woman who said, you know, the book's absolutely terrible, it's incomprehensible, and I'm very angry about it, I'm not coming to the meeting.
Yeah.
Right? And then you've got, this is a completely counter-example, this is the woman who wrote this executive woman's report. She wrote, "Whilst Jeremy Griffith struck by lightning on the road to Damascus, such was my cynicism reading the book. Then whack, wham, reading on, I was incredibly impressed and then converted by his erudite and explanation of society's competitive self-destructive behaviour. The his is not a band-aid cure for humankind sickness, but profound thinking through its biological cause and illness." So she just loved it.
Yeah.
And not only that, she said that she read it all in one night. Right, she had no trouble. It just went straight through. So I wrote to her and said, you know, how was it that you didn't struggle with it being a resigned adult?
Yeah.
And this is what she wrote back. "Our 12-year-old son was killed in a bicycle accident 8 years ago, and God literally hammered on my soul and senses. Miracle signs, phenomena were granted me because I kept open the communication lines and begged God to help me," because she was absolutely desperate. So we call it shattered defence. At a certain point of despair, all the blocks and denials just become meaningless and pointless. And it's like that kid, you know, whose mates were killed in a bus accident. He's become accessible again, you know, to the truth. And he can, and because all the facades become meaningless at that point. And so she could take it in. She said, "I kept the doors open, and I could," and it just, and she just could hear it all. So one person here says the book's terrible, it's incomprehensible, totally impenetrable, and I'm very angry about it. This person says I love to death. So something's going on, very funny. They're polar opposite views. So, you know, you have to immerse yourself in that and work your way through it, you know. But by all means, but you've got to look at the end of it. If you say, well, all those theories, you know, what normally happens if people are fair-minded is they go through and they have a lot of, holding a lot in reservation, you know, like Professor Shivers. Dr. Shivers, because, and that's fine, and that's what they should be, rigorous. But there's a lot that they say, this guy's getting in behind the human condition, that's not a bad effort. There's a lot of things that are making sense. So his track record is growing.
Yeah.
So at a certain point then you say, well, I disagree about autism being lack of mother's love. I mean, you know, and then, so he's hung up at that, and good on him. And let's see what he said. I'll take that on notice and see if it doesn't sort of sort itself out. But, yeah, you have to, at the end of the day, this whole thing will boil down in your mind. It's a wrestling match between, I'm suggesting this will happen, will be a wrestling match between whether humans want to come clean or they want to stay in denial forever. Do you want to just stay living in denial, you know, because it's too frightening confronting the truth, even though we've found the defended truth, you know?
Yeah.
That's why it's called Judgment Day. It's chapter 8, you read about it.
Yeah.
you know, this is shakedown day, draw the blinds, come clean day. It's a terrifying time. It's the biggest paradigm shift the human race has ever had to face.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of resistance, very deep and angry resistance. Well, Plato's not only said, will they not hear a single thing when they get out of the cave, he goes on to say they'll try and kill him. That's how angry they'll be, that he's drawing the blinds on their world, which they're very comfortable in. They're living in their cave. They've got all their theories and stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so you've got to just patiently keep reading it, keep your opinion, and, you know, don't ever, you know, chuck it over your shoulder the moment you think it's full of shit. And but if it's not, do the opposite. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. So just, I got two questions and a comment to go. So why do people that do good things, moral things now, yes, do you think that's their instincts overriding their mind?
Yeah, no, I might do that with the group.
Okay, yep, sure. Okay. Pass that one.
Can you ask that one a minute? Yeah.
How were you able to think of this?
Okay, good one. What's your last one?
The last one's a comment, and I'm just saying, for the book, like, for your benefit, I mean, maybe you should just ask people to read it a few pages at a time. Maybe you should ask them that in the book, if they can just read it extra slowly. Because as you say, that they're going to be initially, and I think it's true with me as well, I was initially more skeptical than I was on a reread. Maybe if you can get them to read it only one or two or three pages at a time, think on it, come back to it tomorrow. Right. If you could put that at the very front.
No, that's really good. Well, what I've got in there, what we're adding to it, is to be patient.
Yeah.
That was the two tools were to watch the videos and be patient as all get out.
Well, at first I was a bit like, oh my God, I'm just a regular person. How am I supposed to read this? But as I'm kind of getting through it, I actually realized that it's not as complicated as it seems, and I can actually relate to what is being said. And it really made me think of like when I was studying and how I felt when I was younger, like, you know, you're talking about it in adolescence a lot, and how I was feeling and how I'm feeling right now as well, because I'm a person who can be really frustrated in life with like other people, can be a bit of a antisocial. And it made me think, okay, why am I like this? Maybe this is actually an explanation to all the things that I've been feeling. So it actually really interested me. And as I was getting through it, I wanted to know more and more. And I'm quite looking forward to reading chapter two and getting the answers to finally, like, this big introduction of okay, now I understand. This is something that we really need to consider, and I want to know more. So some paragraphs, I felt like I was reading it, and then at the end I was just like, whoa, wait a minute. I just had to reread. But sometimes I actually chose to reread because I felt like it was a really important bit, or because, for example, you talked about Catcher in the Rye, and that was a book that I read in high school and I really liked, and I really wanted to understand like what I understood back then, compared it to what the book would compare it to, and see and understand a new perspective, and also something that the teacher obviously never talked about. We talked about that book for a long time, and it actually struck a chord with me because I was going through adolescence reading that book. So I could kind of, and I was going to this like really exclusive high school with all the phonies, and I felt like I could really relate to the character and understand what he was going through, but without knowing what it was. I just assume it's the adolescence crisis, like everybody calls it, but what is it? Who knows? You just know you're going through something. So it kind of like, it felt like I could understand a bit more of what happened back then. And and it's quite like, it's quite big, I feel. Like you can understand a lot of the things that you never understand back then.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I think it's pretty powerful.
Initially, I was pretty stimulated by it. I thought it was it was quite interesting. It's been a while since I've read a philosophy book, so it sort of drew me back into the books I've read over the years. That was the first thing I enjoyed. I liked the concepts, the sort of good and evil argument, everything from Nietzsche and so forth. I did like it up till about around page 15, page 16 or so of the first chapter. I was really enjoying it. All the sort of mixing the modern references, you know, Catcher in the Rye, or modern 53, but relatively, you know, Beatles, and making it all stand out a little more to the more modern reader. And I like that. That was bringing me back to base with it. It sort of lost me a little bit towards the second half, mostly because I found that the argument that was being put forward was being put forward for humanity, for the general public, whereas it seemed to be for the more pessimistic person. For example, when they said that, you know, at the age of 14 or 15, we have this sort of generalization, this realization, I should say, about the human
condition.
At that point, I thought, you know, that's not, I don't really feel like I had that. I feel like it's sort of a pessimistic view, and I do know people who would experience that, and not just at that age, but in general. But I couldn't quite relate to it, and even when it was referring back to, you know, Plato's cave, things like that, there was certain assumptions that were sort of made by the author, and I'm not so sure. I mean, there was a little bit of A plus B equals C when I'm not so sure it was, I think it was too big a jump to make, basically. So he was sort of cherry-picking a little bit of the facts. But for the most part, all the way through, I felt quite stimulated by it. And by the end, I sort of, it made you question yourself a little bit about just daily life and, you know, maybe I should make a couple of changes in my own life. So that's got to be a positive thing.
Yeah, in chapter 2... it's a it makes sense. Not 100% sold yet, but I think I need to keep need to read further chapters, because I really want to mostly like the explanation of why we do have this instinct to be good people. Like, I know there was the instinctive
what?
The instinct to be like that we are loving people.
Yeah, moral nature.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, because you did briefly talk about that in the first chapter.
Yeah.
But I would just like more background on that, which I'm sure.
You know, that's really interesting stuff. When you get, that's chapter 4, and it's all about bonobos and nurturing and stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
And being a biologist, you'll be jumping out of your skin, I think, when you get there.
Yeah.
But there's some big questions still, so you should be taking it on notice and just... and as a biologist, and she didn't do all this stuff in biology, well, you know, I still found it pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I did. It's kind of disappointing that we don't ever talk about those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, that's right, because it's scary. It's the core issue, and we've never been able to make sense of it and come up with all these false theories from when we're living in the cave, but... So, yeah, it is the question. But it, like I said, even Darwin didn't address it.
Yeah.
You know, he, the origin of species, I mean, the most interesting species we know the origin of is ourselves, but humans aren't addressed at all in the origins of species.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 11 years later, he did put out another book that made some references to human behaviour, well, a few, but, yeah, and in origins is... Stark emission, it's just amazing. And not amazing, because that, the next frontier is the human condition, and that's this horrifically scary subject. So, good on you, Elise.
Personally, I liked it, and I didn't find it difficult to read. Maybe because I belong to science, I don't know. But the first pages I found... in a moment, I felt like, are we talking here, seeing the human being like a negative thing only?
Yes.
Up to page 6, if I remember it right. But then when I started reading further all the explanations, I actually got the figure.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's my personal...
Interesting.
What I thought while reading.
You're in education. You did agriculture.
Yeah, science. I am in agricultural environment, University of Sydney.
Yes. So this subject of the human condition, have you encountered that before in any of your reading or studies?
As a term, yes. But that's why at the start I thought, is this regarding only to the negative side
yeah.
of the human being?
Yeah.
or thinking. It seemed that I didn't have a full understanding of it,
yes.
Which I did find it through reading the first chapter.
Yes. Yeah. Was it interesting how...
It was very interesting, but to understand it 100%, I think people have to know all the artworks you have
yeah.
included,
yeah.
which is beautiful, I like
yeah.
that,
yeah.
and you have referred to,
yeah.
Because a few of them I didn't know, so I had to research,
yes.
and then you get the full picture.
Right.
The talk actually helped me a lot. I could reach understanding of some points that I couldn't in the first reading I had. It did. You explained it very good. I was happy, and that's why I got interfering. I actually like it, as I said. I find myself in there.
Yeah.
So not only for my son's
yeah.
Case, but for myself as well. I have kind of been in a bit of depression once
yeah.
for circumstances, some circumstances, and so I do find it. And yes, you're right, that human condition is kind of forgotten, and we don't get to think of it. We just think of the cause of our problem, that is something physical that happened or something spiritual in case of losing someone, a loved one or something. That was my case. So yeah, but we forget that actually it's there. We are human and this condition
mm.
exists.
Mm.
We have to refer to it.
Mm.
That's how I understand it.
I found parts of it very easy to read and smooth flowing. Other parts I really had to labour with because some of the sentences were really quite long and complex. And I mean, if you've got an interest in the subject and you have an interest in philosophy and know something about it, then, you know, you can work your way through it.
Yeah.
And obviously what's being offered is a new perception of, you know, an answer to this question that, you know, all of humanity has been wrestling with. So it's a profound subject. And some people would have an interest and just do the work to get through it.
Copyright FedMex 2015. www.humancondition.com